Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, how to see the pyramid-shaped zodiacal light. The latest science report on keeping imported food and drugs safe. And a supernova is born and a mystery solved. Here's a scientist's soundbite.
This is the best time of year to see the zodiacal light in the evening if you live in the Northern Hemisphere.
That's Sky Watcher Deborah Bird. More with her later, but first, Science News of the Week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
Late last month, European astronomers announced that they'd found a planetary system around a very ancient star, nearly 13 billion years old. In other words, this star and its two Jupiter-sized planets appear to be survivors from the extremely early universe.
On April 3rd, a round of severe thunderstorms pushed through the area around Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, and triggered 11 confirmed tornadoes. The storms produced high winds greater than 120 miles per hour and did a lot of damage. Fortunately, there were no deaths.
Astronomers have caught six distant galaxies in the act of capturing the ingredients needed for building stars from extragalactic space. They hope the discovery will help them understand how galaxies can keep making stars even when the raw materials for those stars run out.
Research released this month shows that in 2009, one in every 30 babies born in the United States was a twin. Now that's in contrast to one baby in every 53 in 1980. Scientists say the increase is due to the growing availability of fertility treatments and because women today are having children at older ages.
Scientists announced a new 3.4 million year old partial foot fossil. It was found in Ethiopia. The foot's owner did not belong to the same species as Lucy, the most famous early human relation. The scientists who discovered it say the partial foot fossil shows that Lucy's species, which walked upright on two legs, was not the early species related to humans living in this region of Ethiopia 3.4 million years ago.
NASA released an image on April 4th of a dust devil on Mars that was 12 miles or 20 kilometers high. A NASA spacecraft orbiting Mars caught sight of this huge whirlpool moving across the sands of northern Mars. It's high summer now in Mars's northern hemisphere, so that part of the planet is subject to the sun's most direct rays of light and heat. And that intense sunlight is precisely what was needed to form such a giant dust devil. I'm Emily Howard. That was our news of the week.
And I'm Michael Brennan. This week's Song of the Week is a new one by Dana Falconberry. It's called Possum Song.
I am not really alone. If there are stars in the sky, how could I be lonely with so many small winking lights? And I am not all by myself. If there are birds in the trees, how could I become lonesome with so many songs sung for me? Oh, oh, oh. Thank you. glowing face shining down. Oh, and I am not all on my own. If the wind is high, how could I become lonesome when it whispers my name blowing by? Oh,
was Possum Song by Dana Falconberry, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Deborah Bird is here with news of the global night sky, the eerie zodiacal light, and how to see it for yourself. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. This is the best time of year to see the zodiacal light in the evening if you live in the Northern Hemisphere. So if you live in the Southern Hemisphere, it's the best time to see the zodiacal light in the morning. So if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, just take everything I say about the evening and do it before dawn.
Okay, good. So what are we looking for? What's happening here?
Well, so the zodiacal light is legendary. It's when you do see it before dawn, it's called the false dawn. And so what you're looking for, you need to be outside in a dark location after the sun sets. And you know how when the sun sets, you've got twilight for a little while, like say for 45 minutes to an hour or longer, depending on, you know, where you are on the globe. And as soon as all traces of twilight have left the sky, so, you know, for some of us closer to the equator, that might be an hour or so after sunset, you're going to see this strange glow appear in the western sky, the same direction that the sun went down. A strange cone of light, like a pyramid of light, appear in the western sky, and that is the zodiacal light.
It sounds amazing. So what is the zodiacal light? What are we looking at when we find it in the western sky early evening?
Well, as it turns out, there are little grains in our solar system. So our solar system being our sun and its family of planets. And of course, the solar system is kind of flat in the same way that the Milky Way galaxy is flat. The solar system is also kind of flat. All the planets orbit more or less in a single plane. Also in that plane, there are little grains of dust. And when sunlight shines on this dust, we see the sunlight reflected back as the zodiacal light.
That is so cool. So it's not quite as eerie and mysterious as it may appear to be. It's just light bouncing off these grains of dust out there, remnants of when our solar system was created.
That's right. 4.5 billion years ago. And, you know, you might wonder, why is this a good time of year to see this? And the answer is that the path of the solar system across our sky, which is called the ecliptic, and by the way, we just put a great article up at earthsky.org on the ecliptic. So if you come to earthsky.org and search for the word ecliptic, you'll find that What is the Ecliptic article. But basically, the ecliptic just traces the path of the sun across our sky. And the moon moves along that path and the planets move along that path because, again, everything is orbiting more or less in the same plane around the sun. So at this time of year, in the months of March and April, and even into May a little bit, the ecliptic is more or less standing straight up with respect to that evening horizon. So you can imagine what's going on at the opposite time of year, say around, you know, September, October, something like that. Then in the evening, the ecliptic is lying down kind of flat with respect to the horizon, and you can't see the zodiacal light. But at this time of year, because the ecliptic is making that very steep angle with respect to the horizon, we can see this very mysterious and beautiful glow of light in the western sky.
And people can come to earthsky.org and see a great article about everything you need to know about seeing the zodiacal light or false dawn. Anything else, Deborah?
Well, one thing I want to say about it is that a lot of people see this light and don't really know what they're seeing. So a really common time to see it is if you're taking a road trip and you're, you know, driving along, for example, in the country, and you see this weird glow in the western sky, and you may be, you know, watching it for an hour or something until it fades from view, and you may be saying to yourself, wow, that's a weird glow, and it kind of looks like the glow of a city or a town over the horizon. So if you are out and driving in a dark location and you see something that looks like the glow of a city or a town over horizon, but you know there's no town out there, that may very well be the zodiacal light.
That's awesome. I'm going to be looking for it. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Much of the foods and drugs consumed by people in the U.S. come from other countries. Almost 40% of the fruits and nuts and 85% of the seafood that Americans purchase comes from abroad. What's more than 80% of active pharmaceutical ingredients are imported, and 40% of medicines are imported as finished products. The Food and Drug Administration is tasked with ensuring that these imported foods and drugs are safe. The FDA asked the U.S. Institute of Medicine to assess what can be done to improve safety of foods and drugs in the country where they came from. And in April of 2012, they released the consensus report, Ensuring Safe Foods and Medical Products Through Stronger Regulatory Systems Abroad. On the line to talk more about it is Jim Riviere, Burroughs Wellcome Fund Distinguished Professor of Pharmacology at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. Dr. Riviere chaired the committee on the food safety report. Dr. Riviere, welcome.
Thank you.
What are the main findings by the U.S. Institute of Medicine in its April 2012 report on ensuring the safety of foods and drugs imported from other countries?
Well, this report assessed what is happening relative to imports coming into the United States and realized that they are growing and will continue to grow, and essentially that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration can't guarantee food and drug safety alone. It needs to work with other partners. And those partners include other mature regulatory agencies in the world, including the European Union, Canada, Japan, Australia, and similar well-structured agencies. And also private industry has to do more. We were tasked by FDA to look at foods, drugs, and medical devices. So you're looking at very, very different types of products. I think people have to realize that FDA is responsible for keeping track of 20 million different product lines. So that's not 20 million products. That's 20 million product lines, like a specific drug, a specific food type. There has to be a realization now that we say imports from other countries, but very few products really say just made in the USA. Most of those products will have a component from some other country. So what really has to change is the realization that we live in a global economy and that our food and drugs are sourced globally, and that this line between domestic production and global production really doesn't exist anymore. And so FDA needs congressional approval to start actually realizing that the resources have to be able to be flexible in this type of an environment.
Dr. Riviere, thank you for taking this time out to speak with us. What's the most important thing you want people today to know about science and the safety of food and drugs worldwide?
I think the most important thing is there's a lot of new technology and new science that is being applied to these areas. It's a broad, open potential to develop very simple but very accurate and sensitive techniques for improving product safety. Things just change so rapidly that science can keep up with this. We just need to create systems that can keep up with the science.
Dr. Riviere, may I ask one just follow-up question on that? Would you give us an example from the report of a new scientific tool that's being used to keep foods and drugs safe for people here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think without getting to very specific, a lot of focus needs to be on developing field-ready analytical type devices to determine and detect microbial contamination or to determine whether the active pharmaceutical ingredient is actually in a product. That type of technology, handheld, the technologies that aim toward nanotechnology and other areas that really allow very sensitive techniques to be present in very cheap and field usable situations. That's an area that's it's absolutely wide open for growth. That's going to make a difference. And electronic technology. What's happening in every day with Twitter or Google, that type of an approach would be very useful to actually detect when outbreaks occur and catch them before they enter the U.S.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, actually just monitoring like social media activity for when people tweet about, I've got bad case of diarrhea or something.
Yeah, exactly. There's actually in our state with a UNC project with Noel Grease has worked a pilot project doing exactly that, assessing Twitter activity, assessing hospital submissions to start determining is there a potential food outbreak. These kind of things are occurring in little spots everywhere that the technology is available now to bring that globally, and we need to really foster that.
You've been listening to medical researcher Jim Riviere. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Astronomers from Louisiana State University say they've solved a long-standing fundamental problem of what makes a star go supernova, specifically a Type 1a supernova. Astronomers have long considered them standard candles to measure the age of the universe. Their luminosity caps out much like a 60-watt light bulb. The problem is, what creates these supernovae, whether they were created by the collision of two compact stars called white dwarfs, or whether just one white dwarf siphons off mass from a companion star to become that supernova. Dr. Schaefer analyzed images from the Hubble Space Telescope to find out that two white dwarfs, 160,000 light-years away, spiraled into each other to create a supernova. Brad Schaefer spoke with Earth Sky in Austin, Texas, January of 2012, at the 219th meeting of the American Astronomical Society.
A Type 1a supernova is a particular type of supernova. It's a big thermonuclear bomb, kind of like an H-bomb, although on a much bigger scale. And these are particularly important for understanding cosmology, the age and fate of the universe. And the double degenerate part of it there are jargon words for a system where you have two white dwarfs, and those are small, compact core X cores of stars, two white dwarfs going round and round in close orbit around each other, and they ultimately spiral in, and after some relatively long time, they'll spiral in and collide with each other, and when that happens, they explode as one of these Type 1a supernovae. But the question is, where do they come from? After large amounts of research, about 30, 40 years ago, people realized that, well, the thing that had to explode would have to be a white dwarf, in particular one made up primarily of carbon and oxygen. And so there's long been a tension and an uncertainty back and forth between knowing whether these Type 1a supernovae happen to come from this single degenerate or double degenerate, that is, whether they come from a pair of white dwarfs or whether they come from a white dwarf with a companion star spilling matter over onto it.
Dr. Schaefer, did you find the solution to this type 1 progenitor problem?
Yes, we did. We have indeed found a very decisive solution to the type 1a progenitor problem. I had described how there are these two basic classes of models, the double degenerate and the single degenerate. Well, one way you can go distinguishing them is by looking at what's left behind. If you have two white dwarfs spiraling in, well, basically both white dwarfs get blown up, and you're left with nothing left behind. Alternatively, if it's a single degenerate, well, you have a white dwarf and a companion star spilling matter over, well, when the white dwarf blows up, well, it'll blow off a little bit of the gas on the companion star, but the companion star will be largely intact and not changed, or not changed by much. So the dodge we're using is to try to find out whether there's an ex-companion star left behind after the eruption. So the trick we use is we look inside a supernova remnant. Well, that's a big gas cloud blown out by the explosion of the white dwarf. And somewhere close in the center, deep in the center of that, should be any ex-companion star. So the idea is you pick a good case supernova remnant, hopefully fairly young, and you look deep in the core of that. If you go finding an ex-companion star, bang, you've just proven that it's a single degenerate. If you find no ex-companion star to deep levels, well, there's no ex-companion star, so you've ruled out single degenerate, so it has to be double degenerate. That's the logic we have.
You've been listening to astronomer Brad Schaefer, and that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know.